explain those Badlands. That's a hell of a name.
Yo.
Julian's Realm, I'm going to hijack this stream from the start, as is my want.
As is your want.
We were having a little, you know, pre-show shoot the shit session where we intricately plan out all aspects of cultural heretics. And he revealed something to me that I'm going to go ahead and blow up your spot. I want to share my screen right here because I want the audience's reactions. So this describes Julian's Rum's current state of mind. if I were to pick where he's at right now on the left chart, I would say he's in the bargaining stage already, which is rapid considering when this asymmetric event literally wound up on his doorstep. He probably feels more like the right-hand chart, but I think we're already getting right toward the acceptance stage. So why don't you tell the people what I'm referring to? Give them some context, and let's see if we can source the correct position from the audience.
Yeah, so a bit of background. You know, my wife loves raccoon videos, thinks raccoons are the cutest things ever, because they are cute.
They are.
They're little trash pandas. You know, and we live out in the city, so it's not like raccoons are like a problem for us, really. You know, I mean, if anything, they might get into our trash, but whatever. So it was like Monday night. We were taking our dog up for a walk, and we open our door, and literally right on our front porch is this baby raccoon just looking up at us. I mean, it's probably like 5 or 6 weeks old, and immediately you just feel terrible for it. It's missing an eye, you know, but it's obviously trying to fight the good fight and survive. And, you know, my wife immediately just like falls in love, you know, sees it as a sign from God that we're supposed to take this freaking raccoon in. And then, so I go through the whole, like, look, it's a wild animal. We, you know, we'll do what we can. We'll give him some food over here. He's obviously got a little spot by our front porch where he's camping out. Fast forward a couple days later, I'm taking my dog for a walk in the middle of the day, and I see this poor thing like in the middle of our parking lot. He's like, yeah, dude, it's exactly what it looks like. He's camped out like right in the middle of the parking lot, trying to get some sun, trying to get warm. And I'm like, God, all right. And then, you know, I told my wife, Mike, he's out there. Let's put him in a friggin' box. We'll give him some food, you know, put some towels in there, get him warm. So he's on our back deck right now, in a box, and he's making it. At least it looks like he's making it. But I told her, I'm like, look, we can't have a raccoon pet, you know, like Instagram people who have these raccoon pets that, you know, they either have an infinite amount of money, you know, or they're doing it for the content. So, you know, we can't be raccoon people. We have enough trouble trying to get people to take care of our damn dog when we go out of town. I don't know what it would be like to try and get people to take care of a raccoon. So all that to say, it is really tough because it's so freaking cute, you know, and it's trying. So I'm like halfway between like, well, let's just try and keep it alive, you know, in the meantime, and like set it free. But he's still got some fire. Like he'll, you know, he'll bite at you if you try and bottle feed him like that and shit. You know, and
I'm just trying to illustrate to the audience. I'm not trying to influence you in any way. I'm just, some people don't know what raccoons are. And I thought, especially baby ones, I just thought this would help illustrate what you're dealing with. So your determination is, so you're being the dad meme that is like, listen, we're not keeping the dog.
Right.
And
except it's a raccoon.
On the next episode, you and the raccoon are going to have matching t-shirts with each other's faces on them is, I think, where we're going in this storyline.
So I told my wife, so we are calling the local, you know, wildlife rehabilitation people. To my wife's credit, she's called them several times a day that they're not answering. So again, this is all not great news for me because my wife sees it, you know, as a sign that we should keep this damn thing.
I mean,
and so yeah, we'll see where this goes.
At that. See, bargaining. He's in the bargaining stage. It started. You started this. This episode's been on for less than 5 minutes, and you started with a firm denial of any raccoons in your life, and now we're gonna see where it goes.
I mean, here's the thing. I'm also trying to be like, you know, the responsible. You know, because as a dude, you know, I imagine like what my grandpa on the farm would do. It's like, you know, we're not taking in the damn raccoon, right? Because it's a damn raccoon. And they're almost too smart for their own good. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what the hell to do with a raccoon. But at the same time, it's so cute, y'all. Like when I open up the box to feed it, it like does that thing where it covers its eyes like this, you know, to try and hide. And it gets at me, and I feel like a pussy because I feel like I should be less empathetic.
In all seriousness, I poke fun, but I would the kid actually we found a baby skunk and tried to, I think it was dehydrated, then it ended up not making it past a couple of days, but I remember having it in a blanket and bottle feeding it, and I never knew skunks were cute, right? Because as a kid you just see them, you see black and white and you're like, get away from this thing because it's gonna get you, it's gonna spray you. And then I saw a little baby one and held it, and they're kind of the same. They're pretty similar, where they got their little hands and
I saw someone
the position
who said someone said you got to name it. Here's the other problem. I've kind of already named it. I've been calling him Pippin.
A great raccoon name too.
I know, from Lord of the Rings. And what's funny is my wife, she didn't like that name at all. And I'm like, well, that's his name. He's Pippin.
So you're telling her we can't keep it, but you've already named it and argued with her about the name for it.
Yeah. So anyways, that's where we are. That's been the highlight of my week. I want to let the folks out there know I am not going to be able to join our friend Biebs here on the show for the next two episodes. I'm going to be taking a long and much needed vacation with my wife and her family. We're going to go on a little sailing trip. So, Biebs is going to be holding down the fort with hopefully some fun, impromptu guests, but
Pippin the raccoon, keep it going. All right, man, we can get into the actual show now. Should we grab our sponsors here?
Do the sponsors. First up is Gold Co.
All right. It's a good week for Gold Co. Good week for gold and silver alternative assets. Are you concerned about the $6 trillion at stake in the upcoming election? The Wall Street Journal's reported a critical issue, the looming decision on extending tax cuts scheduled to expire after 2025. Republicans advocate for extending Trump's tax cuts while the Democrats lean toward letting them expire and increasing taxes on top earners and corporations, potentially creating a massive $6 trillion gap. Fear not, there's a way to protect yourself from this impending threat. Join the thousands of hardworking Americans who are taking proactive steps to safeguard their savings. Visit BadlandsGold.com to claim your free 2024 gold and silver kit. Fortify everything you've worked for. You may even qualify for up to 10% back in bonus silver, but hurry, supplies are limited. Don't leave your financial future to chance. Act now to diversify and shield your savings against the uncertainties ahead. Get your free 2024 gold and silver kit today at BadlandsGold.com and take control of your financial destiny.
Dude, I just saw that Chuck Norris was one of the endorsements for Gold Co. I can't imagine a better
endorsement.
Yeah, dude. That's great. For literally any product, like Chuck Norris is giving you the thumbs up.
He just threatens you into buying some gold. Gold just getting right back toward its all-time highs along with a lot of stuff. Turns out the only things not buying into Bidenomics besides everybody is actual assets like gold, silver, Bitcoin, etc.
My pillow. Here we go.
I'm excited to announce we're having a huge MyPillow spring sale. And here's a few examples. Buy one of our MyPillow 2.0s, you get another MyPillow 2.0 absolutely free. Made with cooling technology, the best pillow ever just got even better. And this just in, 9 brand new colors and styles of our Percale bed sheets. They're made with the finest long staple cotton, and now you can save 50% or more. That's as low as $24.98. And for the first time this year, I'm bringing you our My Slippers and Sandals for as low as $25 a pair. So go to MyPillow.com or call the number on your screen. Use your promo code to get your MyPillow 2.0s. Buy one, get one free. Percale sheets as low as $24.98. My slippers and sandals as low as $25 a pair. And for a limited time, when you order $75 or more, your entire order ships absolutely free.
Hell yeah. So I actually have a pretty good MyPillow advertisement myself. I don't know how many married couples are out there that are struggling with this every night like I am. In our bed, we have Well, I'm counting one, two. We have five pillows. Okay, three of them are mine. All right, I have my regular pillow, like my big body pillow, and then I have a pillow that like I kind of put smash over my head, and that is literally a my pillow. What my wife likes to do in the middle of the night is try and steal that pillow from me and claim it as hers. And like literally at 3 a.m. the other night when she did it, I turned over, I go, see where it says my pillow right here? This is literally my pillow. But see, what frustrates me is that she won't get one for herself, but she'll just sit there and try and steal mine.
That's what they do. Like, you give and they just take and take and
keep
take.
They keep taking, man.
What I didn't say, speaking of Julian's Rum's partner, is that I am nursing a bit of a conspiracy theory about that first segment there. She's talking about baby raccoon, she's all involved with them, and then one of them just shows up on the doorstep. A little strange.
Was it a plant?
Mm-hmm.
I saw someone in the comments say it was a fed. Could be.
They are suspicious little fellows.
They are. Oops, man.
There's one behind me. See, he's very ginger the way he moves around. He doesn't even knock over that Prince Vegeta statue there. He's very careful.
Oh, let's jump into our segments. Clown Crown of the Week. So this one comes from Ayanna Pressley. She's a Dem rep. I believe she said this in the House the other day, but let's go ahead and tee it up for you.
I'm so tired of white men failing up. This lack of accountability is a shameful, inadequate, and deeply unsatisfactory, and it is re-traumatizing.
She's tired of white men failing up. A lot to unpack here. So yeah. First of all, the blatant racism, and you know, we're all so sick of this, and it's just, we go through the whole motion of, you know, just imagine that a white guy got up there and said, you know, I'm so tired of black people failing up or whatever. I mean, literally would never happen. Also, it would also just be wrong. You know, I mean, that's not something that's just, it's blatant racism. And the other thing that I always laugh about, have you ever noticed how like the left, like what they will always do is throw out that term trauma or traumatizing, because again, it's always about restating the victimhood status. And like, if you're going to say something extremely boldly racist like that, then you have to immediately insert how, you know, well, we're traumatized by these people, these white men who keep failing up. And it's just, it's so transparent. But you know, I hate the, because what it does inherently is it puts everyone in an us versus them mentality, because a lot of white people's core reaction is going to be, well, fuck, man, like, what, should I just start being racist back? You know, is that the solution to this? And I think that that's what's so insidious about it, is that like blatant racism like that, it's only going to breed more racism from everybody else, which is exactly what they want. Yeah. And I think another insidious thing about it too is how, you know, we always hear the line, it's like, well, you can't be racist to white people, which makes absolutely no sense. I mean, because it's like, well, you know, they're a privileged class, you know, you can't be racist to them because they have everything, therefore they hold the power. So it's like, that's not racism at all. Racism is literally you are judging a group of people by their race. That, I mean, that is what racism is, and that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
And man, I just like, at this point though, I think that people really are beginning to wake up. Even like, you know, a lot of people, you know, Dems who would have fallen for that in the past, like in the black community, they're like, dude, y'all are just doing this to deflect off of all your, you know, worthless bullshit that you've been throwing at our community for these years. But it's got to stop. At some point, it's got to stop.
Yeah, it's actually kind of funny, because we talk about this in a lot of segments. The idea that the irony that somebody like Pressley there, she's so clownish and cartoonish is the term that we often use, because, you know, these ideas are cartoonish no matter which way you slice them, but there's ways to deliver this kind of stuff in sort of new speak, to take an Orwellian term, in college speak, university speak, where more clever Marxists are able to dress this kind of stuff up in language such as, you know, colonialization, microaggressions. They build these language frameworks around what they're saying that ultimately ends up coming out in what you described, which is the belief, the foundational belief that you can't be racist against white people. I have a friend, close friend of mine that I grew up with. His shockingly his estranged wife, who he is no longer with, the woman of color who literally told me that to my face when I basically dismantled her belief system about her blatant racism toward white people and convinced her that she was being racist against white people, which she basically finally admitted until she then devolved to the foundation layer, which is you can't be racist against white people.
Well, that's so, the backdrop, right? That's yeah. The get out of jail free card. It's like,
exactly. It's once you've got them to admit that they are engaging in what would be considered racist behavior. Because when you first say they're being racist, they say they're not being racist, that what they're saying could right. not be construed as racist. Eventually, they will admit that, of course, everything they're saying is incredibly racist if white being white was a race. And this actually reminds me, last week, Chris Paul and I had done Gangs of New York on Story Hour. And that was a fascinating exploration. But one of the little tidbits that I wrote down during that movie was, the movie deals with Americans dealing with the unchecked immigration of the Irish into New York at the time. And what's interesting is you had American whites, English whites, Protestant whites, Catholic whites, Irish whites, Polish whites, Russian whites. You had all these different sub-races of white people, these ethnicities, that were all disagreeing with each other. The same thing we've seen throughout human history. And I said, you know what's funny about this? It's not even the point of the movie. But as recently as the 1850s, there was an acknowledgement that not all white people were the same thing. And now, because that doesn't suit their narrative, it turns out if you're Irish, you're Polish, you're Russian, you're English, you're American, you're a mix of every which thing, it doesn't matter. You're a filthy colonizer, white person. That's what you are. It's a total inversion. As Chris often says, it's an inversion within the false reality. It's just the story that they're telling us.
Well, what's also funny about it, too, is that they're trying subtly to make, because they'll say whiteness, right? It's their way of trying to make being white into an ideology.
Yeah.
Well, it's sort of the way they get around, you know, the claim of racism, too. But they, right. they can't get away from it, because at the end of the day, it still all falls back on, like, you're white, therefore, you know, you are an evil colonizer, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact that they've built in, like, you know, what it means to be white, you know, oh, you know, you're a colonizer, you know, you benefit off of, the, you know, the hard work of, you know, minorities, et cetera, et cetera. The thing is that... But dude, there is no like unilateral. There is no such thing as an ideology behind being white. There isn't.
Yeah.
If there were, you wouldn't have what we have today. I mean, it's that simple. And I have some theories as to like what is going on with that exactly. You kind of see parallels a little bit to, you know, what Hitler did back in the day. I mean, it's just a way to sort of like. You build up resentment to a certain group, and then you weaponize it, and then you're off and running. Now, there's a lot of luggage that comes along with this that needs to be unpacked. But the point is that it's that tried and true classic, you know, bifurcation of society, make right. X group hate X group, and like, you know. I heard, I think it was like, I can't remember what his name is, maybe Jesse Owens. He's this awesome black guy, but he talks about like, look, at the end of the day, like, look, white people were the ones that were carrying this country and trying to make everything right. Are they perfect? No, we're not perfect at all. And I'm not saying that we're the ones carrying it now, but the point is that they're trying to sort of, it seems like, weed us out of society, yeah. which is alarming.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty, it's I think that, at the beginning of the segment, you mentioned they want controlled opposition. They want there's a lot of different terms for it: controlled opposition dynamic, false binary. They want these things. It's part of the Hegelian dialectic, the problem reaction solution dialectic through which communist subversion has worked for at least since the, you know, Soviet takeover, the communist takeover, the Bolshevik Revolution in the early 1900s really kind of perfected this, but. It's important that we do call it out. You know, you don't want to fall into the controlled opposition dynamic, like you said, and then and start being racist against the people being racist to you, which is what we definitely don't do. But it is important to not bow down to it anymore, or to not even bow down to it, but to sort of be cowed by it and not be able to call it what it is. And I've really resolved, it's kind of shocking for somebody like me who's never been, I never lack for opinions. I'm known for being opinionated in my personal life. And yet, I will admit that in social situations where this might come up in past years, I'm not really going to go into my true thoughts on it because I'm like, it's not worth it. These days, I really have a counter-striking mentality, which is if I go to a freaking work event with my wife or something like that, and somebody makes some racist comments because they're insulated in this little bubble of local politicians, I'll say that that's a racist sentiment. You know, like I consider it a counter-strike. As long as you're standing in the truth, instead of just acting like the truth is subjective, then I think we've all got to practice doing that more, whether it's friends or family. There's no more of this get along to go along to get along, all that kind of crap. It's, you know, you can, if people self-select themselves out of your life because they can't handle the fact that you don't like being treated differently because you're white, or that you apply this to many things, it's not just race. Like you said, with white culture, they're trying to brand MAGA. They're trying to brand nationalism, populism. Look at the prime minister of the Slovak Republic was just shot yesterday. Why? Because he's a populist, and the UK media was almost cheering it. So this is what they're conflating populism with whiteness, with colonialism. And I just have one question for them. If you go to Haiti or if you go to Africa and you have one black tribe that subjugates and massacres another one and seizes control, is that tribe now white? Are they black people exhibiting white culture? How does this work? Can you explain to me this? Or is it white people's fault that they're doing that to each other? I assume it's the latter, but I'm just not sure.
You can't help but notice either. By the way, it was Jesse Lee Peterson was the name of the guy that I was trying to get out. I can't remember if I said Jesse Owens or whatever. He's awesome. I highly suggest his shit. But they're also trying to create to conflate Christianity with whiteness. And you see this more and more now. There's actually this great clip of this this preacher who goes to college campuses, and this this white liberal girl tries to tell him that, you know, Africa is only Christian, you know, because a bunch of white Christians brought it there. And then luckily there was this Ethiopian man there, and he was like, Africa was Christian before the white man ever came to Africa. Ethiopia is arguably the oldest, one of the oldest Christian communities in the world, alongside Armenia. And it was at that moment that I kind of realized it's like they are also trying to make the idea of Christianity into whiteness. And again, this goes back to, if there's one thing that they're wanting to destroy more than anything else, it's Christianity. And if they can sort of conflate the evil white man with Christianity and get everybody away from it that way, that's how they're going to try and do it.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, speaking of just the language games they use, I often refer to it as branding. So your point about white Christianity, you notice a few years ago, it was white nationalism. If you search that term, you see it everywhere. You still see that a little bit everywhere, but you know what they've shifted to?
Christian nationalism.
Yep. So isn't that interesting to your point? It started as white nationalism, now it's Christian nationalism. What they're doing is they're conflating, they're making white a synonym for Christianity. If you're white, you're Christian. If you're Christian, you're white. You're probably a nationalist. Nationalism is overwhelmingly positive as an ideology, but they hate that, right? So it's the oldest thing to me that the thing I laugh at the most is the establishment often says that these ideologies are a threat to their democracy. And I say, well, they're telling you the truth there, because we're not a democracy. We're a constitutional republic built largely on the tenets of Christianity, and they can get fucked.
They sure can.
My crown clown is in the realm of fiction. I'm not even a fan of this property. If you want to share my screen here, the new Doctor Who show debuted on Disney's networks. Some people in the chat might be aware of this show. It's really the most famous kind of genre fiction show in the UK. You can kind of think of it maybe as an analog to Star Trek, the British version of Star Trek. But it's a beloved show, really interesting, or has been for a long time, has all this lore. And the way it works, the key sort of conception of it is that the Doctor is this interdimensional being that exists outside of space and time. So each season of the show is a new actor playing the Doctor, and it's canonical within the fiction of the show. So you get a new actor, and this is the new incarnation of the Doctor. The Doctor was a white dude, white British dude for a long time. The last incarnation of him was a blonde white female, of course. And this one is, I'll just let you show what the newest Doctor Who is.
Who are you?
I'm the Doctor. It's called the TARDIS. It's
so, he's a colorful fellow in more ways than one. Obviously, he's African-American there, but African-Bretonian. But he is he's also flamboyantly gay.
Yeah, let's say effeminate.
Yep, and this is actually from a special they did recently. And I just want to show people how woke... This seems like if you told me this was a parody skit making fun of wokeism in current entertainment, I would believe you. This is from a recent clip from Doctor Who.
She's looking after Wilf.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
Meep.
Yes, the meep. I promise I can help him get home and then you'll never see me again.
You're assuming he as a pronoun.
True. Yes, sorry. Good point. Are you he or she or they?
My chosen pronoun is the definite article. I am always the meep.
Oh, I do that. But you were shot down. Who wants
Holy
you dead?
Holy shit.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost shocking. So the context of that scene, apparently, is obviously the Doctor is sitting down with this alien creature and says he, and he is reprimanded by a black
diverse
transgender...
individual.
That's a guy, that's a biological male that's sitting on the couch with him that the show passes off. So there are layers of woke subversion going on in this scene where you have a white doctor being criticized by his apprentice, who is a black man in the real world playing a black female in Doctor Who, reprimanding the doctor about misgendering or mispronouncing a Muppet. Furby, yeah, a meep, like a, whatever this thing is. And it will shock you. Yeah, sorry. And it will shock you to know that the ratings for this show are down. I did want to share one more thing here. I'll just read it. I liked Zero Hedge. One of their commentators put out an article about what's going on with this Doctor Who stuff, just how popular it is in Europe and everything. It's an attempt at subversion. But I really like the way that they frame this, because we often get strawmanned in these arguments about some of these legacy shows. He says, it is common these days to hear leftists in popular media argue that TV shows like Star Trek or Doctor Who were, quote, always woke, and that they are simply carrying on the tradition. This is simply not true. While many productions in the US and in Europe displayed liberal sensibilities, woke activists are not liberal and do not hold liberal values. They are rather a hybrid ideology combining elements of Marxism, communism, fascism, collectivism, moral relativism, and narcissism. And I think that that's a sneaky, important distinction. I often refer to myself as Badlands as a reformed liberal. But really, what I think of as liberalism, I still believe in. It's just that this is not what they have done is they have taken cultural Marxism and they have branded it as liberalism, where some of the founding fathers, including the Adams, who I love, obviously, as a Boston boy, are liberals. They're classical liberals, and they've rebranded what liberalism is, and they're using the most ridiculous versions of it in pop culture right now.
Yeah, and we talked about this a couple weeks ago. If I'm not mistaken... So it sounds like they're going to be changing up the Doctor Who, like, because it's a multiverse bullshit thing, right?
Yeah.
So they're combining the classic Disney wokeism with the Marvel universe of, you know, multiverse, which is, so they're removing all of the stakes while also inserting all of the massive wokeism into every single episode, which to me, it's like, what the hell what do I even want to watch this show for? Anyways, I mean,
right.
And the funny thing about moral relativism and, like, you know, the only truth is there is no truth, which is essentially what these people live by, is why does it even matter then? Like, what the fuck I call him, or, you know, he, she, they, zay, blah, blah, blah. It's like, if there is no truth, then literally nothing matters. Okay.
Yeah. My truth is that you're a dude.
Right. Exactly. It's a self cannibalizing philosophy. And it's really just a fascist philosophy more than anything, because it's like, what they're really saying is that I hold all of the truth in my being. And that's the whole like relativism thing, right? The only truth is my truth and how I'm experiencing the world. And it's just, what it does is it feeds egotism. It feeds narcissism. It just, it turns you into a little sort of like mini tyrant, you know, like whether you're at your office, you know, whatever, you're a party, it's a way to be a tyrant to absolutely everyone around you, because you are dictating how everyone is allowed to act, what they're allowed to say, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, it's a great point. And I think often, I think a way to conceptualize the sort of useful idiots within this Marxist cult, which is a huge swaths of Western society these days, we often talk about the more sort of planned, top-down, subversive elements of this ideology, because it's true. We've got power structures that are trying to enforce or codify these ideologies, spread these ideologies for a reason. But most of the adherents to these ideologies don't know any of that. They're unaware of any of this. What they are, to your point, is they're retarded in a way that I'm not even trying to be funny by saying. They are retarded in the literal sense of the word, they are delayed. Their development is permanently delayed. They live in a state of constant gratification. Moral relativism, to your point, it allows for a logical framework through which to just continue acting like a five-year-old.
Yes.
And there's a reason that when a four-year-old hits another four-year-old at the playground, a good parent disciplines their child. They don't hurt their child, but they discipline their child, and they do it in public. That discipline may be, you know, to embarrass them or to show them, you know, you're teaching them. That's why you do that. You're showing a consequence type of culture. And, you know, it's not shocking that most of the most ideologically driven parents or friends that you can think of, if they have kids, those kids probably suck, don't they? If you run through the Rolodex in your head of the people you know, the parents you know, who are the most subversive, the most insufferable liberals in your friends or family groups, their kids probably suck. They're probably selfish. They have no respect for anybody. And it's because they are retarded in their growth. They are not, they have never been disciplined in any way. They live in a consequence-free ideology. And that's annoying when you're dealing with a five-year-old. It's insufferable when you're dealing with a 15-year-old.
Exactly.
It's dangerous when you're dealing with a 35-year-old who is in positions of societal influence and power over other human beings.
Well, they can vote. You know, and then that's when things become really dangerous. And that, I mean, that's their whole goal, right? Is to just, it's to your point, mentally retard people to the point where you have them voting to get rid of the Constitution. I always said that the way that you're, the only way that they can destroy America, we all know that they can't invade, you know, you have to do it from within. One of the ways you do it from within is you make people so stupid and delete so much common sense from their brain that they vote for their own demise. And that's what we see happening.
Yeah.
Before we jump to the next segment, though, I would like to pause and say, please give us a like. We really appreciate it. It wouldn't be an episode of Cultural Heretics if we weren't whoring ourselves out for thumbs up. So we're going to do that right now.
And if you and that does help. I know a lot of people watch this show on replay. They watch it Friday. They watch it Saturday when they're kicking back. Hitting the thumbs up helps us no matter when you do that. And since, again, a lot of the audience watches this on a delay, if you do want to send a question or comment over to us, I've got a couple from last week. You can go to badlandsmedia.tv. You can click the support tab. You can select this show specifically and send over either a donation or a question or anything like that to us.
Nice. Heretical Hero of the Week. So mine is a little bit... It's going to seem a little strange at first, but I'm just going to go ahead and throw it up. But I'm going to give it to you... old Joe Biden this week.
Donald Trump lost two debates to me in 2020. Since then, he hadn't shown up for debate. Now he's acting like he wants to debate me again. Well, make my day, pal. I'll even do it twice. So let's pick the dates, Donald. I hear you're free on Wednesdays.
Okay.
I love him. I'm starting to unironically love the guy.
Exactly. I mean, like, that was the first thing that shot through my brain. I was like, good Lord, Joe. I mean, awesome, man. Awesome.
You're
job,
doing
buddy.
So great. Yeah.
Good for you. And I immediately knew it was the right move because Nancy Pelosi was really kind of pissed off that this is happening now and said something along the lines of, you know, like, he should refuse to debate Trump altogether because Trump is a liar, you know, all the other terms that we've heard, and all he'll do during the debate is lie, lie, lie. And I think this is it's going to be mid-June with Jake Tapper and I can't remember who else moderating it.
A diverse woman commentator.
Yeah. But man, I was listening to other people analyze this, and they're like, you know, it only benefits Biden to do this because, believe it or not, like, if he would have refused to debate Trump, it would have, you know, just made him look even more weak, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. I agree with that to a certain extent. However, I only think he can ride that up until the actual debate itself. Like, yes, he is going to have that little bit of, you know, swagger to him up until that June debate where everything falls apart and, you know, all of the meth that they've injected into his system starts to wear down. Because, like, look, you know, back in 2020 during those debates, first of all, that was 4 years where Joe Biden's mental decline wasn't as progressive as it is now. Although, again, I've made the case that I think that a lot of this is an act from Biden. But let's just pretend.
You, me, and I know that Just Human is on that train as well. But either way,
because look, we all know that this debate is only going to benefit Trump. It just is. I mean, and the point I was trying to make was back in 2020. People, I think back then, more or less had their minds made up right before the election who they were going to vote for. I'm not sure that those debates had that much of an effect. I think that now they are going to have a much larger effect for all those people who are on the fence right now. Like, we all know that they're sort of like they're having that coming to Jesus meeting in their heads. They're like, all right, I might have fucked up on this one. But. I'm going to give Joe like one more little chance to sort of see if he can redeem himself. Maybe if during this debate, he'll show me a side that I haven't been seeing. I don't think they're going to see that side. I think they're going to see exactly what they need to see. And I think it's going to finally be the straw that breaks the camel's back for a lot of people that sort of pushes them in that common sense direction to finally swallow their pride and vote for Donald J. Trump in 2024.
I think it's a good way to frame it. It's, you know, the casting Biden as a heretical hero is something I play with, and it's because of the net effects refrain. That's kind of one of my go-tos. It's what I often talk about. The reason I started talking about the net effects refrain a couple of years ago was we all acknowledge, even though we disagree with each other on various things in the chat and the community, whatever, we all acknowledge that we're in an information war. That by definition, if you are acknowledging that, then you are acknowledging that you are being misled and lied to by both sides. That doesn't necessarily mean it's for ill intent. Patriots aren't necessarily lying to you on purpose, but they're lying to their enemies with their public sort of narratives, which is why you have to look at, if I don't know the intentions here, if I don't know whether Joe Biden is still working earnestly on behalf of the deep state or has been compromised by us, by the good guys, and is working out a plea deal, trying to gain plausible deniability for when he faces justice, any whatever sort of theory you want to play with, if you can't decide which it is, because we do not know which side of that binary it falls on, you have to look at the net effects of his deployments. The net effects of his deployments are catastrophic for the side he ostensibly represents. And doing this, that you knew it was an issue when Donald Trump immediately accepted his terms, his rigged terms. So we often talk about how Trump lays out bait, and then immediately, I've been calling these the debates because I'm extremely clever. So I thought that was an incredible pun and want full credit for it. Yeah. When you see Con Inc. influencers using it, I want you to trash them on my behalf. But this is why. This is how it works. He lays the groundwork. He seeds it. He lays the bait. Biden takes the bait. The establishment are the ones who didn't want him to. And then the last point I'd make on this is that myself, John Harold, and Kyle have often said that when it comes to devolution, continuity of government, a Patriot plan, where your mileage may vary on what you think a Patriot plan is. But most of us agree that there is one and that Trump is heavily involved in it. The longer that Joe Biden is their representative to the American people, the more I see it as a proof of us being in control, because it is not how they drew it up. They did not draw it up this way. You can never, ever convince me that they genuinely believed this was their best bet to represent the establishment.
And we've talked about it before, too. Like, Trump had made comments right up before Biden was the official nominee, where Trump sort of implied, he's like, why haven't they chosen Biden yet? You know, are they fishing for someone else? I think they're going to. I think they have to. Almost sort of being like, I have trapped them into choosing Joe Biden, where they cannot make another choice. And I don't pretend to know how he did that, you know, what mechanism there was. But to me, it was pretty evident that they didn't want to go with him. Now, I don't pretend to know if, like, Biden is some fucking, you know, android clone, you know, or double whatever he is, who's up there, you know, just as an actor. But
a series of raccoons stacked atop each other's soldiers.
But it all amounts to the same thing at the end of the day. And it's not a net positive for the other side. So, yeah, no, I think it is a real proof. The problem is that, you know, in the years to come, shit, even now, we all want to know. I think the question is how. How is this all possible? Like, how do you, the logistics of coordinating such a thing, how the hell do you do this? Yeah. I don't know. I think there are lots of different mechanisms they use. I'm not sure that we'll ever know, by the way.
I think a lot of it we will not. The choice to know will be yours in many ways.
Exactly. So we'll see.
Absolutely. And there's a rant that came through here. Can Trump debate from jail if he's found guilty in New York? That'd be awesome and hilarious. Any way you play this out, any way you play this string out, again, speaking of bait, a lot of us believe that Trump is baiting them. He's baiting the judges. Kyle and I think that he will be in jail, that he will be in an orange jumpsuit, temporarily, of course, and it's just going to be juxtaposed against this clown in the White House. You know, you mentioned at the start of this segment that the American people, the normieville that we kind of talk about, the reachable normies, they didn't really care too much about the debates the first time around. They didn't really care too much about what Biden has said. You know, if they weren't on either side at that time, they couldn't be swayed, maybe, because things were pretty good. Mm-hmm. You know, we were talking about problems, but things were pretty good in Normieville. But when things are not pretty good, that's when normies start to go, huh, who is in charge right now? And who stands in opposition to the person in charge? And who said that all of these things that have indeed occurred were going to occur if we put the wrong man in there? Now, we think the election was stolen, but besides that, the narrative is that Joe Biden won the election and he was going to fix all the problems that Donald Trump caused. There's a lot of normies that won't even admit it to their friends that are saying, well, this didn't quite go the way that the Biden establishment said, and it seems to have gone almost exactly how the other side said it was going to go.
I think you're 100% right. And I always think about this, like, how much meaning does this, more meaning, I should say, does this bring to the phrase hindsight is 2020? Because we're literally seeing that play out. You know, I mean, like,
oh yeah,
if people are looking back to 2020 being like, damn, man, in hindsight, Trump was right.
I wrote about that. I was like, how far back does this plan go? Because now I'm wondering about the seeding of that term.
because, like, they're only really one of two options. It's like they deliberately, you know, tried to line everything up so that that term would be applicable. Or, you know, and I also find this an equally valid argument, is that, look, there is a bit of God's hand at play with all of this. You know, there has to be to a certain extent.
I agree. There's some synchronicity going on with hindsight 2020. That's the year. That's the year of the stolen election. It's the year of establishment. And for us, we front ran that narrative, right? We knew this going in. But for most people, it's going to be in hindsight. Yep. For us, we're like, of course COVID was bullshit. It was obviously bullshit. You're a dumbass if you bought into it, or a coward. And I know many friends and family who did. Like, they're dumbasses and cowards. I'm sorry. You guys can be smarter with the benefit of hindsight. I don't hate you for it. But you were idiots and you treated everybody else like chattel. So, you know, you get what you deserve on the timeline in which you deserve it. You vaxxed up 3 times. You're a dumbass. You vaxxed up because you were going to lose your job. You're a coward. It is what it is. It's time to come to Jesus, right? Jesus can be logic, doesn't have to be literal. It's just hindsight's going to be 2020. I really agree with you that that term is going to take on such added context and meaning in the generations ahead.
Yeah, and look, here's what it takes for me to regain respect for those people is you have to admit it. You have to admit to yourself that you were a coward, that you were wrong. Otherwise, how are you going to improve? I mean, like, if there's one admirable quality I think that I ever had was that, like, I was at least willing to admit that I was wrong. Mm-hmm. I admitted that I was wrong back in 2016 or 17 because I didn't vote. I didn't vote at all. You know, I fell for all the bullshit. But the only way that I could move forward with my support for Trump was to admit that I was wrong about him and everything else that came before that and Biden and the media lies. I mean, I think St. Augustine of Hippo, you know, because he – I think he said his parents, and I could be wrong, but his parents originally grew up in the tradition of Manichaeism, and it's sort of like a Gnostic religion. And what's important about that is that it really doesn't place much emphasis on sin at all, or if at all, and on everything on knowledge. And, you know, mm-hmm. St. Augustine talks about, like, the problem was is that I couldn't acknowledge when I grew up in that ideology, I knew I had sin. But it was sort of like I refused to acknowledge it because it didn't really work into that framework, and I needed that outlet to be able to move forward and, you know, to come to terms with Christ and my Lord. And I think that that's important. You know, it's sort of we have to acknowledge our sins. I'm not saying like yet the Catholic and go confess them, but we do have to confess our sins and confess the fact that we are sinners and that we fuck up and we get things wrong.
Well, that's a great framing because people sometimes recoil at that who are not religious or spiritual. But there's a logical framework to apply to that you just laid out. It will literally make you a better person, and it will make you a happier person. One of the ways I was coping, not always successfully, with my constant anger and frustration from 2020 through 23 about our friends and family, people I thought were friends and family, being not only idiots, but assholes about the choices that my wife and I made, that we've never gotten apologies for. So if any of you are watching, we're still waiting. I know they're coming in the years ahead. The way I would cope with that is saying, well, we are frustrated dealing with this crap and people trying to enforce these views onto us and take the vaccine, put the mask on, shut up about your opinions, trust the government that's lied to you for 100 years about everything ever. All of that kind of stuff is... who was actually in more mental anguish? The people like us who were frustrated at the way we were being treated, but were seeing through the lies? Or people like them who actually were going through the world thinking, if I just do what the government says, if I just do what my boss says, if I just do what mom and dad say, then I'll be happy. Were you happy? Were you happy strapping 3 masks on and taking 3 boosters and acting like a little slave? I mean, because it doesn't seem like it. And you notice this because the silence is deafening. These people who couldn't shut their mouths about you vaxxing up and everything. That's why I'm not joking. I want them to try it again. I want them to try to roll out the bird flu crap or whatever it is.
Yep.
Because I want to see all of those people that told us we were being irresponsible. I want to see how many of them reject it this time. Because most of them are going to reject it. And then again, they'll have to apply hindsight to the 2020 era.
Yeah, I'd love to see it too, because I think that they would be much more ballless this time around. I think what bothers me though is like the reason you're still waiting on those apologies and that those people are silent is because, look, they're still addicted to narcissism and egotism, right? They can't burn away the narcissism that they have that's preventing them from admitting that they were wrong. I mean, it's really that simple.
The vaccine didn't save you guys. It just didn't, because everyone who didn't take it is alive and well, probably has much more of their DNA intact. my heretical hero, I'm doing the more Hollywood type stuff this week. You want to share my screen here? Francis Ford Coppola, famous director. I do not know a lot about this man's views. I'm not saying he's a good guy. In the context of this, well, actually, you shielded me by picking Joe Biden as your hero, so I can basically pick anybody. Francis Ford Coppola, probably best known for the Godfather trilogy, obviously one of the most famous directors in world history, really. He's got a new movie coming out. I'll just play some B-roll here to give you an idea of it, called Megalopolis. And what I find interesting about this movie, it's got a kind of amorphous plot. It's very vague in terms of what it's about. I don't know if the movie is going to be great or not. The reason I think it's cool is Francis Ford Coppola has been trying to get this movie produced since the 90s. He's pitched it to many different studios, but it's artistic, it's kind of experimental. Maybe the ideologies in it they don't want. So he never got it off the ground. So what this baller decided to do at, how old is he? 85 years old.
Yeah.
Is he funded this movie himself. He founded his own production company. And he put $120 million of his net worth into the production of this movie, wrote the script, cast it himself, paid the cast himself, paid the production himself. And it's an experimental type of thing, but it's just really cool to see. I know, obviously, most directors, most creatives are not in the position of a Francis Ford Coppola. They don't have the cachet or the money to do this. But I think it's cool to see one of the sort of Hollywood elites stepping off the reservation because, you know, who's not happy about this is the studios. If this is successful, they don't like that. They don't like one of their legacy directors, one of literally their most famous directors ever, like a paragon of that whole industry, kind of stepping off and saying, you know what? I've got the means. I'm going to do my own thing. I don't need the studio distribution. It's the age of the internet. It's the age of decentralization. I'm going to put my work out there. I'm going to see what people do. And if this is his last movie or one of them, I think it's a cool signal flare to younger creators out there of saying, just put it out there. Put something together. Put it out there. And if you build it, they will come.
Yeah, no. And that's the central message, right? Because we don't know whether the movie could be shit. I really don't know. But I think to your point, what they're really worried about is the decentralization message that this seems that you can operate outside of the system. Now, yes, obviously it is hundreds of millions of dollars, but still the core message is there that like you can choose to go around these people if you want to. And that's what he's chosen to do. I love a lot of Francis Ford Coppola's movies. I think Apocalypse Now is a great film. Mm-hmm. I believe he also did The Exorcist, if I'm not mistaken about that. I could be wrong.
I don't think he was The Exorcist.
He definitely was obviously all the Godfathers. Hold on.
Right. He did Godfather. He did Dracula, Bram Stoker's Dracula.
He did Bram Stoker's Dracula.
American Grief.
Okay, never mind. William Friedkin. Yeah.
Right.
I don't know why I thought that Francis Ford Coppola was like involved with that though. Maybe he like produced it. Anyways, so yeah, I more power to him. It kind of looks like a neo-noir alternate universe sort of thing. It looks like it's kind of
like Atlas Shrugged vibes.
So we'll see where he goes with that. Francis Ford Coppola is an interesting guy. I also love that he has Adam Driver in it because Adam Driver sort of ruffled feathers.
Yeah, I like Adam Driver.
You know, where he criticized Disney and Star Wars for just the directionless woke drivel that was that script. So I'm hesitant to say it was a coincidence that, you know, Adam Driver was chosen for this role. So
right,
we'll see.
Yeah, he was the lone bright spot to come out of those movies, really. Even people that hate those Disney Star Wars sequels like us, a lot of times when we're ranting and raving about it, we'll add a caveat in there and say, well, Adam Driver was really good given what he was given to work with. But yeah. But a lot of that, to your point, is not even as much about the performance, and it's more about the fact that he didn't pile on and attack fans. And, you know, he sort of took a bit of that Henry Cavill approach, which... turns out it's going to lead to more opportunities in a decentralized free market entertainment future for men like Adam Driver and Henry Cavill than some of these others who piled on during that era.
Yep. He also did Patton, which was one of my favorite movies.
I haven't seen that one.
Never seen Patton? Oh, no. Dude, it's a classic. You got
to
watch Patton.
Check it out. We'll have to
do it
on
Story.
It's
4 hours long, but it's a good one. All right, so we got like what, a little over 30 minutes left. Let's jump into some ads, then we'll.
All right.
We'll wrap with our last segments.
Got our friends at Benson's, the OG sponsor of Badlands. Badlanders love Benson Honey Farms. Indulge in the authentic, unpasteurized, 100% natural honey, product of diligent bees working the fields of wildflowers. 'Tis raw and robust as the spirit of Badlands. When you're seeking a taste that's real, pure, and American, choose Benson Honey Farms, the sweetness born and bred in the heart of Nebraska. Benson's honey-infused candies capture the essence of Nebraska, each bite a delightful taste of home. And don't forget to try the goat's milk honey soap. Benson Honey Farms, a celebration of the America First spirit, a symbol of the resilience of our homeland, embodying the spirit of Badlands. This is a family-run operation, and it's a reminder that the true flavor of America lies in its heartland. Benson Honey Farms, proudly American, naturally delicious. Visit badlandsmedia.tv/honey to pick up a jar today. That's badlandsmedia.tv/honey. I think I've only got about 2 pounds of honey left, so we'll have to make another call sometime soon.
All right. Last up is Good Ranchers.
T-bone.
Good, good.
Chicken.
Good, good.
Bacon.
Good, good.
Salmon.
Good, good.
Ground beef.
Good, good.
Ribeye.
Good, good.
Ranchers.
Good, good.
Ranchers.
Good, good.
Good Ranchers delivers the best meat and seafood America has to offer, and we ship it straight to your door from real farms and ranches right here in the USA. So whether it's beef, chicken, pork, or seafood, you know it's going to be
good, good.
Ranchers.
Good, good.
Ranchers.
Good.
Oh, yeah, I'm jacked up all over again.
I'm hungry.
Yeah, I know.
I am hungry. Mrs. Bright always gets mad at me because I eat lunch at like 4 o'clock.
I know. I do that sometimes, too. And it's not a great habit because then, like, yeah. I'm not hungry for dinner, but then I'm hungry.
Then I'm hungry at 1 in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah, I got to stop that. I don't have the 20-something metabolism that I once did.
Yeah.
And it's going to kill me on this sailing trip because I am not sporting a sailing bod right now. But enough about Julian's bod. Trash trends. So this week, for me, I actually saw this this clip of Shaq's ex-wife. She went on one of those, I can't remember what the woke talk show is. It's one of the talk shows where they were wearing like masks still up until like a year ago. But I'll just play this clip real quick. She wrote a book about her marriage.
She wrote a book. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, she wrote. But anyways.
Said about the marriage, you said, looking back, I don't know that I was ever really in love with the man. It made me want to cry.
Yeah.
But I was in love with the idea of being married to the man I had a family with. I was in love with the idea of building a life together.
Absolutely. I was in love with the partnership that I never got.
You were in love with the money, you fucking liar.
Yeah, what? I mean, you were in love with the idea of being married to Shaq. Like,
see,
I get it.
Exactly. And this is what Bill Burr, I think he talked about this one time in one of his sketches. There's an epidemic of gold digging whores. Like, it would suck in a lot of ways. I mean, I would never want to be a celebrity for a whole host of reasons. But, you know, finding like a soulmate that you can trust and isn't going to, you know, just dive into it for the money and, you know, just picking all the bones. I mean, that would suck. And what sucks even more is they have 4 children together. You know, it's like, how could you even say something like that? Like, so you didn't love the man that you fathered, you know, or mothered 4 children with? I mean, was it really that empty? Or are you saying this now because you feel like
it's 4 checks?
I mean, like, I almost feel like she wrote it because it's like an empowering thing to say. And it kind of goes back to a little bit of what we were talking about before, which was not being able to admit, you know, that you were wrong, or, you know, just admit that you loved the man and that, you know, you don't anymore. I hate sometimes, I think, like, how, you know, marriage has almost become an industry in of itself in this country. It's one of the reasons that, you know, I'm glad that I was raised in the Catholic Church and in the Orthodox Church. And again, I'm not hating on anyone who's not Catholic or not Orthodox, but, you know, in Catholicism, marriage is viewed as a sacrament. It's a holy sacrament. And it's something that, you know, we recognize as it's going to be tough. Marriage is probably one of the toughest things in life. You're going to have children. You're going to go through some shit together, and you're going to argue, and you're going to fight, and you got to push through. I just feel like sometimes nowadays people have sort of just been trained to to give up a little bit sooner, to call it quits a little bit sooner, to not push through a little bit sooner. And I think there are some times where marriage is absolutely justified, you know, if there's a violent relationship, things like that. But to me, I think the vast majority of divorces these days are not that. I think it's really just, you know, people don't like putting up with it anymore. They don't want to push through. And I think one of the core reasons it's considered a sacrament is like marriage isn't just about you and your spouse. It's also about your children. And creating a stable household, you know, for them to be raised in. And like, look, I have divorced members in my family. I'm not, you know, hating on them or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But I will
sometimes
say
it's for the best, but it shouldn't be
for the best.
It shouldn't be flippant. It shouldn't be done lightly.
Right. It shouldn't be done lightly. It's something that, you know, should really be prayed about, and, you know, something that you should fight for. And I don't know. I just think with the whole shack, it just gives you this icky feeling when you see something like that. You're just like, you see the money. You see the money behind it, and it just makes you want to vomit. And I hate it. And it's something that I want to see reversed in the coming years.
Now, I'm not making a direct accusation here, but I did a tiny little 10-second dig when you introduced this topic. Just show you where my mind goes if you want to share my screen here. So I was just trying to do, I just had a, and I wonder what the timing is here with this woman coming out with this book about how she never loved Shaq and her children, right? So Sharif O'Neal, 24 years old, Miles O'Neal, 27, Shakir, 21, Tahira, 27, Amira, 22. And I said, you know, I wonder how old the youngest is. 18, May 1st, 2006. Now, I'm not going to say this is the biggest dig in history, but it might be the most devastatingly quick. When you get divorced and you are a mother, the number of checks you receive a month is directly proportional to the number of children under 18 years old that you have in your possession. And the youngest of those children just turned 18 years old.
So we need a new...
So sometimes 1 plus 1 equals 2. Sometimes 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 equals 4. And when they're 18, it equals 0. So I'm not saying, but I'm saying. We all know what happened here.
Well, it's funny you bring this up. We have a friend in the neighborhood. His buddy had to move in with him because he had gotten divorced a couple years ago. And he didn't have any children, but... He, you know, had alimony payments to his ex-wife, and they end, I believe, this month. And what's funny is that ex-wife of his is now trying to get back together with her ex-husband because,
yeah.
And it's just like, and I remember I told my buddy, it's like, Jesus, she couldn't be a little bit less obvious about the timing.
Right.
Like you would have thought that it would have been smarter to try like 6 months out, yeah. You know, or like. But no, dude. I mean,
it's like when you're on unemployment and you apply for a job the last day, like you're supposed to be applying the whole time, and they're like, you know, I got another 9 months on this. So yeah, it's I mean, don't hate the player, hate the game, but it's the first thing that popped into my head was, I wonder if the youngest of those four kids is 18.
Yep.
And then they were. So that's a good one.
Pretty on the mark.
So, yeah, all right, my trash trend, again, back to Hollywood, back to Disney. They're too easy. They're too easy. I got to do it. If you want to share my screen here. In Bob Iger's own words on an earnings call recently, I want you to hear what he explains their content strategy as being here. This is from Nerdrotic, Gary from Nerdrotic. So shout out to him for clipping this out.
And overall, I feel great about the slate. It's you know, something, as you know, that I've committed to spending more and more time on. The team is, I think, one that I have tremendous confidence in. And the IP that we're mining.
What did you say?
And the IP that we're mining.
IP mining. Old Bob said the quiet part out loud, and quite frankly, it's the best description of everything wrong with Hollywood right now. So
fantastic essay there by Gary. Go to Nerdrotic on YouTube and watch the whole thing from a few days ago. But the trash trend I want to highlight is IP mining. Intellectual property mining. This is now how the studios are publicly describing the artistic visions that they are putting forth and that they are trying to sell to the American people. They are now admitting that we all know they're buying IPs because they're valuable. There's nothing wrong with that, right? Star Wars is a valuable IP. You buy it because you want to make content in the Star Wars world or Marvel or whatever it is and sell it to customers. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But it hasn't gone well, as we've documented a lot and as others like Nerdrotic, like Critical Drinker and beyond have documented for almost 10 years now on YouTube. The problem is when you tell people, when they respond and say, well, you guys don't seem to care about this stuff, at least you could put people on it that care about it so you can make money and put good art out into the world. And they're telling you that, no, this isn't art. We're not trying to satisfy anybody. We are mining IP. We are digging into the ground in this IP. We're slapping shit together and we are just selling it to idiots. That's what we're trying to do. That is our intention. That Bob Iger, for those who don't know, he was literally a weatherman. That's why if you ever see people online refer to him as the weatherman, that's what he was. He's a complete figurehead. He somehow grifted his way all the way up into being the CEO of Disney. He's a megalomaniac, some would say a narcissistic sociopath, but he sometimes puts his foot in his mouth. He's notorious for this on conference calls or investor calls. He is not supposed to say that they are mining intellectual property. He's supposed to say, we believe strongly in the artistic vision of Star Wars and Marvel. But instead he's saying, you know, this shit's almost dry. This mine's almost dry. We're going to buy some other crap to ruin. So I thought it's a trash trend and a fantastic example of it. You know, maybe some B-roll here if you want to share this is the timing was perfect. This isn't Disney, but this is Amazon with their new Lord of the Rings show, Rings of Power Season 2. Probably the worst example of intellectual property mining that I have ever seen. Of course, Tolkien is very near and dear to my heart, but even for people who are not Tolkien fans, it is a travesty and an abomination. It's just content. That's what it is. That's all they think it is. Anyone who thinks otherwise, listen to them tell you it in their own words.
I mean, and this, you know what? It's so funny how, you know, in this argument, you know, we would consider ourselves, you know, the people who are like, we're for free market economies, capitalism, you know, but at the same time, we're the people saying that like big corporate money is ruining Hollywood and films because they have broken it into just a money-making model where all that matters is just like the shareholder, you know, net revenues, et cetera, et cetera. Their art comes absolutely and totally last. It's everything is about if it's not ideology, then it's, you know, creating that shareholder value, both of which they're kind of failing at, which is hilarious. It's like watching a sinking ship and what they've decided to do is to pour more water onto the ship that's sinking. But it's so odd, you know, it's like this dynamic where like, you know, we've become the pacifists in this whole argument. We're the folks who are saying war is bad. We need to stop getting involved in these international conflicts, which we have nothing to do with.
That's an extremist view, Julian.
But and then at the same time, we're also saying that, you know, big corporate money is ruining creativity. It's ruining filmmaking, et cetera, et cetera. But then you have the left on the other side being like, no, we need to drone brown people in Libya and we need to inject more corporate money into Disney. Yeah. And you feel like you're in the Twilight Zone when you're arguing with these people. And
we need to destroy and blitzkrieg Palestine.
Right.
And we need to scoop up the ones that survive and put them into DEI projects on Amazon Prime. That is the only way that we can save the world, I'm convinced.
Oh, shit.
Fat Jimmy might have nailed it in the chat. He says, I have a great new idea for content. Hear me out. We need another Mary Sue hero that saves all the weak-minded, clumsy men from certain doom. We haven't tried it yet. I think you're right. That could save art. That could save American culture. A strong whammon to show all the men who's boss.
Yeah, we're saving culture here every week on Cultural Heretics. Yep. So we appreciate it, Jimmy.
Said about the Mary.
Sorry.
Let's get to the trad trend.
Let's get to the trad trend. So that's what I meant to click. Mine actually this week, I don't know if you saw this, but Peru, the Peruvian government, has classified transgender, non-binary, and intersex people as, quote, mentally ill. It speaks for itself why that's awesome. But what's interesting about this is that up until fairly recently, and correct me if I'm wrong, this used to be the U.S. policy as well, or at least the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the health boards, et cetera, this transgenderism, what is the technical term for it that they used to call it?
Trannies?
No, dysphoria, dysmorphia.
Psychopathy?
Gender dysmorphia, dysphoria.
Yeah, dysphoria. Dysphoria. Yeah.
But the reason it's kind of hilarious, though, how the left has sort of swapped over to say, well, it's not a mental illness. However, at the same time, they are saying that it is, because in order to justify all the medical procedures for it, it sort of has to be justified as a mental
illness. It's a disability.
Yeah, it's a disability, right? So they're saying, like, well, the reason that we're having to do this is because, you know, mentally, you know, they are a woman and it's a medical condition. Therefore, we can justify these surgeries. But at the same time, they'll back it up and be like, but it's not an illness. It's not an illness. It's a condition. It's this amorphous condition. And yeah. It always goes back to what we're talking about with their self-cannibalizing philosophies and belief systems, that they're always going to eat each other. Mm-hmm.
I agree that being a woman is a mental condition.
Yeah.
But let's just move forward.
Yeah, we'll move forward. So, I mean, good on Peru. I've seen a lot of good stuff coming out of South America lately. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether it's Guatemala, Argentina, Brazil. Yeah. And I feel like it's encouraging because we're so dialed into what's happening in the United States. And, you know, we have a pretty good connection with Europe. We see all the shenanigans and insanity that's going on over there as well. But I feel like we sometimes forget about, you know, Latin America or even, you know, the Far East, like Japan, Korea, et cetera. So it's good to see that things are starting to swing in the right directions in those places too.
It is actually a positive way to spin this stuff too, because it's easy to see the stuff. It's easy to see the ways in which the system has been trying to separate us all, cultures, man and woman, mother and child, father and child, black and white, all the cliches. But it is an irony that they are, in doing so and in being exposed doing so like they never have before, they are unifying peoples who beforehand didn't have problems with each other necessarily, but are finding so much more in common. You know, like I found out during the culture war that my favorite show as a kid, Dragon Ball Z, it's the most popular in the Mexico. Whole world. It's Mexico and South America, Brazil. It's so funny. But even that, it's such a great microcosm, right? A show that's about these base dudes saving the world, training mm-hmm. to get stronger, helping each other out, reforming their enemies. Made in Japan, made by Japanese creators and animators, takes off in the West, and now it's taking off in South America. And it's incredible. I mean, these are the things that bind us all together. Turns out that El Salvadorians and Americans and Japanese and Europeans all love Star Wars. They all love Marvel stuff. They love all this crap, and which unifies us as against common ideological enemies, which is what these people are.
Right. And I wish there was a better, because, you know, people on the left would be like, well, you sound like a globalist right now. I was like, no, it's not like we're opposed to the sharing of cultures at all. That's right. Literally happened since the dawn of humanity. That will never stop.
Happen naturally.
Right. But it has to happen naturally. It's not something that you can, you know, jerry rig, mm-hmm. you know, which is what they want. You know, they essentially want a one world government, you know, and that's why I always laugh. It's like we love, you know, getting good stuff from other cultures, the good stuff, you know, and that's what's so great about the system of nationalism is that you can adopt, you know, good policies, good inventions, you know, good, you know, cultural norms, let's say from other countries like Europe. For the longest time, Europeans didn't bathe, you know, they would bathe like once every, you know, 2 months or something like that. And you see this kind of play out in Shogun, where the Japanese, it's really like a daily bath for them. That was a great thing that, you know, the Europeans took on from the Far East, more specifically Japan, which is the daily bathing, you know, staying clean. That was, I think we can all agree that we think it was a net positive for us to have better hygiene. So no, I mean, I'm not opposed to, you know, benefiting from other cultures. And that's why I always laugh too about, you know, the same people who are like globalization, they're also against cultural appropriation. It's like, what the fuck?
It's all self-defeating. It's all self-defeating. Like you said at the beginning of the show, it cannibalizes itself.
Yep.
Ouroboros. That's why I always use the Ouroboros imagery to describe them. That's why, you know, all we're doing is accelerating them destroying themselves. That's kind of the way I see it. My trad trend, it's going to go back to the debate that you brought up with Joe Biden, but I'll put a little spin on it. I want to share my screen here. I just liked this write-up Zero Hedge did about this whole charade. And my trend, I'm gonna summarize it as the use of fight promotion techniques in the info war and in the political realm. I'm a big combat sports guy. Anybody who watches these shows knows that. And this lead up to this debate is following every little piece of fight promotion in the business, in the game that I've ever seen in the political realm. So you've got Donald Trump coming out of a trial, throwing down the gauntlet, challenging in his post-fight interview outside of the Manhattan trial, throws down the gauntlet, calls out his next opponent, Joe Biden. It's a rematch. Everyone knows the judges robbed me in 2020. You've been hiding from me. I'm calling you out, Joe. Anytime, any place, sign the contract, right? Then you've got Joe Biden puts out an acceptance video, which we always see in boxing in the UFC, where he accepts the challenge, but puts his terms onto it. He says it's going to be in this location with these judges and these rules in this environment. This is the money. This is the contract, right? Which is actually usually an attempt to get the other guy to not sign. It's a way of saving face in the fight game. When the guy who's called out doesn't actually want the smoke, what he does is he makes completely ridiculous requests in the fight contract so that the challenger will not accept. And then the challenged can say, I accepted his challenge. He just wouldn't sign the contract. Then you get the mad lad, Donald Trump, coming in here. Please let this truth serve to represent that I hereby accept debating crooked Joe Biden on Fox. So this is the arena, the date, and the hosts, also known as the referees, are going to be Brett Beyer and Martha McCallum. Thank you, DJT. So the challenger shocks the combat sports world and accepts the rigged arena, the rigged judges, knowing that he got robbed last time. So his stock goes way up. He puts the challenged in a horrible optical position where Joe Biden has to show up now or he loses by default. And if the combat sports illusions couldn't get any more obvious, we have the guy left out. We have the third guy who didn't get the sweepstakes. They want the rematch. He's the number one contender. RFK Jr. is the number one contender. He's got sour grapes because the champion and the challenger don't give a shit about him. And he comes out and he says, Presidents Trump and Biden are colluding to lock America into a head-to-head matchup that 70% say they don't want. They're trying to exclude me from their debate because they're afraid I would win. So this is fight promotion. They could not be making this a more obvious. Dustin Poirier challenges Islam Makhachev. Makhachev wants to fight Conor McGregor instead. The guy who gets left out in the cold calls the other two pussies.
Yep.
This is what we're going. And you know why it's perfect and why it shows that we're watching a movie? Because it works. Because it's mimetic. Because it taps into American storytelling. And it all happens, and I've even seen normies picking up on this. This is all parallel with apparently a huge pop culture conflict going on in the rap world between Kendrick Lamar and Drake. So you've got the two most popular rappers going back and forth with diss tracks. And then you've got Joe Biden dropping diss tracks with Donald Trump and RFK Jr. trying to weasel his way in there. You cannot convince me that these guys are in the green room laughing their asses off about how they're just copying rap promotion and fight promotion and using it ahead of a presidential cycle.
Well, what's funny is that if anyone's going to be an expert on fight promotion, it's going to be Trump. I mean, no one is more closely associated with the UFC than Trump. So that's why Trump's like, oh, dude, if anyone's the master of this game, it's me. And if y'all want to dive into this, let's dive into it. And that's exactly what he did. And what I also think is funny, too, is, you know, obviously Biden demanded his terms. And I think one of them was a mute mic, right? So I think that actually is going to benefit Trump. I saw Sticks, Hex, and Hammer. He said something about this where the thing with Trump is during debates, Trump has a tendency, like I do, to do stream of consciousness where he'll just go and go and go. This mute mic is more likely to benefit Trump than anything else because it's going to sort of hem him in and force him to sort of get his bullet points out pretty quickly without, you know, going off on all these tangents. Now, obviously, we love that stream of consciousness Trump, but I think that we're kind of getting down to 0 hour now where Trump is going to need to just lay out in quick, simple terms, here's why this guy across from me is a total incompetent jackass, and here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. So, no, it's been fun to watch. It really is kind of it's all just so surreal.
Yeah.
You know, more than anything, to watch everything start to play out like this.
You got to learn to enjoy it, even though things are tense and, you know, things are rough. If you can try to enjoy the second act, you know, we're in the dark days of the script.
But... Well, you know, and it's fair advice because to me, that's kind of what the show has become for me in a lot of ways. You know, because everyone will see, like, I'm not posting to any of the platforms nearly as much as I did. And it's because, you know, after 7 years of doing this shit, like eventually you're just like, fuck, you know, like it's not as fun. But this show is kind of a way of like, it's rechanneling that spirit. And
take control of it. That's all we can do. We got to try to take control of it. You know, we're observers of a narrative. I do think we participate in it to some degree in this community. We can, to a certain degree, influence the info war, try to influence it. But we're largely observers. But I think you can be an active observer, right? There's passive observation, which is what most normies are doing. And then there's active observation, where you're not allowing yourself to be carried along the whims of somebody else's narrative deployments. Yep. You're kind of analyzing them and taking stock of them and maybe even enjoying them along the way. I saw some people in the chat who are new to the show. Welcome to you guys. One of them was Fat Jimmy in there earlier. We got Sneakin' McGroin. Welcome to the show. Yeah, we're on a weird time slot right now. Maybe that'll change in the future. But if you like the show, share it around. It's a good one to take you into the weekend.
We have fun here. Speaking of which, we actually got through our four segments with 6 minutes to go. So we have a little bit of room for our old segments. The first being Hollyhope, and this movie with Shia LaBeouf is called The Peanut Butter Falcon. It came out in 2019, right before things went extra retarded. And I don't mean to say that because there's a Down syndrome actor here. He's actually amazing in this movie. And the core message of this movie is also amazing. I feel like this is one of those films where Shia LaBeouf almost started to see the light. I highly recommend it. Highly recommend this movie. It is such a feel-good story. I, you know, if I could compare it to anything, it's sort of like Sling Blade, but with way less of the melancholy that's in Sling Blade. And I don't know, it's just a story of brotherhood and, you know, sort of learning to be a little bit more stoic about life and, you know, and the Down syndrome actor. And he does such a great job. And dude, it's such a great reminder too. They're the best people. It's like Shane Gillis says, the happiest, nicest people I know are all people who have Down syndrome. They're just, you admire them in a lot of ways. You wish you could be like them in a lot of ways because they have such a loving spirit to them. And you really feel that come out in this movie. So if you've never seen Peanut Butter Falcon, definitely take a few hours to watch it. I actually think it's only like 2 hours long. So that's my recommend.
I haven't seen that one. Mine, I'll just play some B-roll here. Mine is, speaking of, you know, fantasy adaptations, I hated the way Game of Thrones ended. I'm one of those people. There's many of us. But on the same day, this was a David Zaslav throwing down the gauntlet move over at Warner Media. he published the House of the Dragon season 2 trailer just after Amazon put out the Rings of Power season 2 trailer. And House of the Dragon is a prequel to Game of Thrones. You do not need to have seen Game of Thrones to watch it. And I was recalcitrant to watch this season 1. I was pissed. Yep. I was acting like Game of Thrones killed my dog, burned my house down and everything. It went from being the best show on TV to the worst. House of the Dragon season 1 is a masterclass of storytelling. The best acting I've seen in a show since maybe True Detective. Fantastic storylines, complex characters, incredible production design. Season 2 is coming, starts next month in June. So if you're looking for something to kind of binge or kind of watch over the course of the next couple weeks to take you up to the premiere of season 2 and you like fantasy. And I always recommend the George Martin world to people who are not traditional fantasy fans, but maybe they're curious. The Game of Thrones type stuff is the one to get into. So great, great show. And it was shockingly great to me. So one worth revisiting.
So I took on the exact same attitude that you had because I read all of the Song of Ice and Fire books. I loved Game of Thrones. And then the last season, you know, it was like, if any of y'all ever watched Lost, you know, what it did was it made you hate Lost when you loved it. And then you watched the last season, you're like, I just wasted my life. And that's how I left Game of Thrones. And my brother kept recommending House of the Dragon to me. I'm like, I basically was just giving it the middle finger. I'm like, no, I'm fucking done with them. And then I finally sat down and watched it. I was like, holy, it looks like they're redeeming themselves a little bit, which it was surprising because, you know, House of the Dragon, it's not working off of any direct manuscript of George R. R. Martin's, which to me was what made those early seasons good and what made the later seasons bad is that they just veered off the books and didn't have George R. Martin to go by. I also was worried that it was going to be super woke.
Me too.
And it wasn't. You kind of see that play out in the early part of the season where the relationship between the king and his daughter, you know, because you're thinking it's going to be all like whamming, you know, like I'm woman, hear me roar. But it's all
weak, stupid king.
Right.
He's the best in it. Paddy Considine is like, I think he won awards for it. I mean, he's got a fantastic arc.
I'm going to back it up, especially concerning the fact that there's hardly any content out there these days.
Yeah.
I think House of the Dragon, especially since Rings of Power is such dog shit.
Yeah.
And it still blows my mind that they are making a season 2 Rings of Power based off of the first woke season.
I think
season.
They have to. I was reading that they have sunk so much money into the production that they committed to a certain number of episodes. But yeah, horrible. I do have a couple boosts here from last week. We had Makes Sense to Me Too, sent $20 over, said to Julian's Rum about if Soviets had nuked first, I'd say you haven't read any Dostoevsky. I don't know about the Soviet government, but I've read tons of Dostoevsky, and his books depict Russians well before nukes being good Christian people. Just saying. Well, again, it's the government, not the people.
Yeah, not the people.
Soviet government was not a good one. The Russian government of today is a different government.
And by the way, that Soviet government, those Bolsheviks, Christianity was their enemy. I mean, they were communist folks.
Yeah, so that's a good. But thank you for the boost. And then we had C. Meadows, who said, sent $5 over. Said, BB, this couldn't wait until next DPH. Last night's episode, you seemed at a loss regarding red wagons for kids. Have you ever read Calvin and Hobbes? You could be the poster child for this comic strip. A mischievous kid with his tiger best friend wreak havoc. There are a lot of shenanigans involving a little red wagon. I've not read the comic, but I've seen it. Now I understand what reference you were trying to make. So I hope that satisfies you.
Man, I used to love looking at those massive, like in our school library, we go look at the massive Calvin and Hobbes comic strips. Like they published like thick books of it. That's how I got into it.
Right.
Absolutely loved it.
Loosely based on the exploits of Burning Bright.
Yeah, totally.
All right. That's all we got.
That's
we got
the show
out of here.
For
Look
the week.
This. Perfect. Perfect timing.
Perfect timing. Everyone, enjoy the rest of your week. I will see you in a couple weeks. Until then, BB's going to be holding down the boat. Everyone, mag on, and we shall see you soon. Thanks, guys.
Peace.